Thank you very much, Sam and Rusty. We have a few minutes before we open it up for questions. We'll be alternating questions between the floor microphone and also from the Slido app. Again, if you'd like to ask a question or like a question in Slido, the web address is slido.com, and our code is S as in spring, the number 23, TPS, as in the Philadelphia Society. Before we open it for questions, we do have a moment for comments or questions or clarifications of, among our panelists. So if either of you would care to respond to the other or clarify something or ask a question of your own before we open it up more broadly, you're welcome to do so.
I would like to underline Sam's point that economic policy is almost always a matter of prudential judgment and should not be theologized. And I did not, and I was... I want to really underscore that. The attempt to move from theology to a Trinitarian theology of the economy, I think, is just deeply, deeply misguided. Bad theology and bad economics.
Okay. Then we'll go ahead and open it up for questions. Again, feel free to approach the floor mic. We'll take our first question from Slido, and that question comes from Phil Magnus. And Phil asks, how would you prevent taxes and subsidies from becoming politically captured by special interests, as has always occurred with their progressive iterations?
Never let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I mean, as they always have, so are we therefore not supposed to have tax policies? So we have to have them, and so insofar as we have them, we should be revisiting them on a regular basis to think, well, what ends do we hope to achieve with these tax policies? And I think the ends that I think we properly sought to achieve in the 1980s and so on are different from what we should try to achieve in the 2020s, because the problems facing our country are so different.
And before we begin taking questions and comments from the floor, I'd like to remind you, as Jason did this morning, this is not an opportunity for you to insert yourself as a third panelist today and give a lecture or a speech or a commentary. Please limit your remarks to either a comment or to a question of the panelists. So please, and introduce yourself, if you will.
Okay. Donna Rook, thank you both for your nuggets of wisdom. Your point about the family disintegration was attention-getting. It's one of my favorites. Would you please comment on and consider adding to your list the welfare system, which I personally believe has destroyed poor and minority families? Thank you.
We did make progress in the 1990s with the work requirement in the welfare reform bill, which was certainly a move in the right direction. I agree with you. You get what you subsidize. You get less of what you tax. You get more of what you subsidize. And if I was the integralist czar, the Caesar that Nathan Pinkosky suggests, I would have welfare payments that would be double the amount for married parents, you know, impoverished married parents with children. So if a woman was married, she would get twice as much welfare as she would if she was unmarried. It's a go-nowhere idea in the United States in 2023, but that's, I think, the kind of way. It's always good to look at what would be the ideal way to allocate subsidies, in this case, kind of consumption subsidy. And I think we should always be thinking, how can this consumption subsidy actually nudge people towards marital stability?
Sam, do you care to comment?
Can you hear me? Okay. So I believe it was Daniel Patrick Moynihan in 1967, who, of course, a liberal Democrat from New York, who pointed out that the Great Society programs embarked upon by Lyndon Johnson had been a major contributor to the destruction of African-American communities around the United States. And of course, he was pilloried for saying this. It seems to me that critique is still valid. it's still absolutely valid. And I also think that it acts as a disincentive in many cases for people to actually get married.
Mm-hmm.
So to that extent, I tend to view the welfare state, which so many religious leaders are just completely uncritical of, just completely uncritical of. There's no such thing as a welfare program that could ever possibly go wrong. The negative side effects, that you look, read through these church documents, they never talk about the negative side effects of these sorts of things. So I think that if one is serious about trying to restore marital stability and family life, you need to think about the way in which welfare states incentivize people to act in ways that don't lend themselves to people entering into lifelong marriages of love and commitment.
Okay, Sam, I think you've dovetailed nicely with the next Slido question, which is directed to you. And Ben R. Crenshaw asks, would you support state Sabbatarian laws to inculcate the religious habits necessary for virtuous markets, even though this would curtail economic freedom as well as profit?
So these are laws mandating closing of enterprises and businesses on a given Sabbath, right?
I think that's correct.
Well, okay, fine. But we don't live in a Christian state or a Jewish state. We live in a pluralistic society that has been profoundly shaped by Judaism and Christianity. When the state gets into the business of mandating what are essentially religious commandments of this type of nature, of the positive type of nature, mandating that you will behave in this certain way. I'm not talking about the negative things, about, you know, don't kill, don't steal, things like that. I'm talking about the state mandating certain things that are reflective of the command to rest and things like that. I don't think that's actually going to encourage a great deal of respect for the actual meaning of what things like Sabbath are actually supposed to be about. I think it actually, here's the thing. Whenever the state gets in the business of promoting these types of religious norms, expectations, and habits, it generally doesn't work out so well for those religious organizations, particularly in pluralistic societies where people's degree of belief is going to differ, where there are different views about the nature of religion and its importance in society. So I think by all means, if people don't want to work on the Sabbath because of their religious convictions, that's great. But mandating it, I think, is to bring politics into a realm which I don't think it's supposed to go.
Yeah, Rusty, is that something you'd like to comment on?
I disagree on that. I mean, it's a matter of prudence. It's not something that could be, I think, successfully implemented in New York City, but maybe Fargo, North Dakota. I don't think that the purpose of Sabbatarian laws are to, I mean, partly it is to put a fence around commerce so that people actually go to church, and I think it did have that effect actually in the past. I think an area where we can take action is in some localities, especially in the Midwest, people are just sports crazy. And my clerical friends say that in the last decade, there's been a real invasion of sports scheduled games on Sunday mornings. And I think local jurisdictions ought to prohibit sporting leagues from scheduling games before 2 o'clock on Sunday. And I think the state has an interest in encouraging piety. I think the state has an interest in encouraging citizens to have a disposition towards religiosity. I agree with Sam, if you mandate that people go to the Catholic Church or mandate that they go to the Congregational Church, it would be extremely counterproductive. But I think that kind of regulation of the public square in order to fence off the time on Sunday for people to go to church, I think in a lot of jurisdictions in the United States that would make a lot of sense and it would do a lot of good.
Can I quickly respond?
Of course.
I don't think that the drop of church attendance has very much to do with laws or regulations about who can and who cannot open for business on a Sunday. I think the drop in religious observance for Sabbath, for Sundays, et cetera, has a lot more to do with people not believing the claims of the religion. So if you have disbelief, you can have as many regulations as you like. It is not going to encourage people to think about these things in the way that one would hope they would. Because unless it's a matter of internal conviction, it cannot help but breed resentment, which is not healthy for religious organizations.
Thank you very much. Our next question is from the floor, and please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Josiah Lippincott. I'm from Hillsdale College, where I am a PhD student. My question is about mass immigration. The Pew Center says conservatively that there have been 70 million Americans who either have immigrated since 1965 or who are descendants of those who have immigrated since 1965. And I think this large block of human beings crossing borders has radically changed our economy by both depressing wages, causing the price of housing to skyrocket, and has also served as a political block for the political left. And my question to the panel is, how can we have a free economy when our political leadership can make a decision to elect a new people for the regime and essentially undermine the older institutions and stability in the communities that made the old political order possible?
Thank you.
Big question. There's no doubt that high rates of immigration have depressed wages for high school educated Americans who compete for low-wage jobs. I think that, you know, basic economics 101 on supply and demand would predict that, and it seems to correlate, that theoretical observation seems to correlate with the stagnation of wages for working class Americans over the last generation. So I think that that's something, and also, you know, we reached peak homogeneity in 1970. I think 3 or 4% of the population of the country was non-native born. We're back up to the level of where it was before the gates were closed in the early 1920s of around 13 or 14% of the country non-native born. I'm a pro-immigration in the sense that, you know, I think our country benefits from appropriate levels of immigration, but I think prudence tells us that at some point a country loses its cultural coherence when the percent of the population that's non-native born gets too high. I mean, what is too high? Is it the present amount? Is it 20%? Is it 25%? Is it 30%? But I am shocked when I go to public fora and those who support really effectively unlimited immigration refuse to answer that question. They refuse to say there's any point at which it would become a political problem for any society that wanted to maintain its coherence. Europeans are much more realistic here. I mean, the left-wing progressive prime minister of Denmark is very much of an immigration restrictionist because she does not believe that her society will sustain its generous attitude towards income redistribution through its elaborate welfare system if the population becomes too heterogeneous. Why should I pay for some newcomer coming as opposed for people, you know, my relatives, et cetera, et cetera. So I do think it's a question that we need to face as a country, but the political situation, the political circumstances don't seem to allow for any kind of sober assessment of how to revise the immigration system we currently have or the extremely dysfunctional immigration system we currently have.
Well, I'm pro-immigration as well. I am, after all, an immigrant. But what's interesting about immigration is the policies at the moment are, as Rusty said, extremely dysfunctional. It's really easy to come here illegally. It's very hard to come here legally. That is exactly the opposite way as how it should be. So that's the first point. Second point, immigrants just don't come here and consume things. They start something like 25% of new businesses in the United States. If you look at even some of the major tech firms in Silicon Valley, at least 25% of them have one or more people who are an immigrant. In other words, they are wealth creators. Now, I happen to think that when you come to the United States, you shouldn't be getting welfare. That should be completely off the table. I agree with that. But viewing immigrants as a sort of drain on the economy, I think, is just simply mistaken. It underestimates their capacity to create wealth. It underestimates their willingness to take a risk to leave basket cases like Cuba and Venezuela and Mexico and come here and make a life for themselves. They tend to be much more concerned about things like rule of law and property rights because they've seen these things systematically violated in their own countries. And many of them, frankly, are a lot more religious than a lot of white working class Americans, which is where religiosity, I think I'm correct in saying, has dropped off dramatically. As for wages, it really depends upon which part of the sector of the economy you're talking about. We've seen wages go up in particular sectors. We've seen wages go down in particular sectors. We've also seen more people over time gravitate to higher wage earning sectors of the economy, which is what you want. You don't want people staying in 1950s manufacturing jobs producing products and services that are completely redundant anymore. So I think there's all sorts of good reasons to think about how we should be reforming immigration in ways that makes it easier to come here without people going on welfare and thinking about them as people who can be net contributors. One of the big differences between the United States and Europe in this regard, of course, is that the profile of the immigrant who's coming to the United States is very different from that of the people who are going to places like France and Germany, et cetera. They're coming from very different religious cultures which don't embody some of the same conceptions of liberty and notions of government, even understandings of what an economy is and things like property rights. Very, very different from what's going on, what are the norms in place in Europe. So there are reasons why in Europe they have good reason to be concerned about this. The profile of immigrant coming to the United States is very, very different. And I don't think that they're necessarily a lock-in block for the left either, by the way. We've seen more and more, for example, Hispanic Americans moving in the direction of voting conservative, and a lot of that has to do with things like religiosity. They look at things like transgenderism and think, are you out of your mind? How can you possibly think this way? What is wrong with you people? So I have a very positive view of the way that immigration works, and I think that actually, in many respects, it's much more likely to bolster the religiosity of the country, which we desperately need, rather than diminish it.
But would you agree that there are cultural limits? In other words, the point being that a good statesman wants to preserve cultural continuity. And to do that, you have to assess you have to have a sort of cultural policy with respect to immigration, not just an economic policy.
Yeah, I mean, immigration is obviously not just an economic phenomena, although that is what often drives immigration. It's the reason why so many people come to the United States. They're looking for opportunity that they don't get elsewhere. But yes, there's obviously a cultural dimension. So if 20 million jihadists turn up at the border at Mexico and demand entry, I would say absolutely not, for the simple reason that you believe things that are simply contrary to the way that the United States operates. It's contrary to the founding. It's contrary to the way that we understand constitutionalism, rule of law, all these sorts of things. So yes, there is a cultural dimension, but I think in many cases we should be looking at cultural affinity, and I think there's a lot more opportunities for thinking that way than they are of the contrary nature.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Sam and Rusty. Our next question comes from Slido, and it is from Joey Beretta. And Joey says, Rusty, you advocate for community college, but many here in this room have come from the very best schools. How can we grow the intellectual movement from within programs of relative less prestige?
Yeah, I'm not sure supporting community college is not a policy that I would propose in order to buttress the intellectual cadres of the conservative movement. I think it's just a good idea in itself. We've way over-invested in the top 20% in our society. The amount of money we've put into higher education is really quite extraordinary. Something like 26% of high school graduates now graduate with a BA, and I think 18% actually get jobs that require a BA. So we're really looking, let's call it 20% of the current generation of 18 to 21-year-olds are benefiting from huge influxes of federal subsidy. So if you run McKinsey, your HR is funded by endowments, rich parents paying tuition, and the federal government, as high IQ kids are aggregated to just a few schools where you can go and recruit. But if you own a manufacturing company that makes tool dies, and you want to hire somebody, you have to find them, you have to train them, you have to pay for all of that yourself. So it's really not a surprise that I think, it's not a surprise that we've had a kind of hollowing out of manufacturing and other kinds of economic activity, in part because we've subsidized so heavily the kind of human resource, if you will, development for this sort of high-end service industry. So I think we need to really invest heavily now, and we need to shift direction and invest in, and we need to ask ourselves, like, we need to invest very much in the median American. So I would say, have the investment in the top 20%, double the investment in the median American.
Thanks very much. And our next question comes from the floor, and please introduce yourself.
Evan Huck, Furman University. And my question is that when markets traditionally arise, they do so with an ethical foundation. And this obviously includes consent, but also there's prohibitions like with, you know, pornography and illicit drugs. But now we see that there's an unraveling, and even people on the right support any market transaction as long as two people say yes. And my question is that should we make a more strict and rigid ethical code for markets? And how should we do that?
Well, as I said in my remarks, one of the things that Judaism and Christianity certainly do is that they, while affirming things like market transactions, private property rights, all these sorts of things, they make it very clear that this has to occur within a particular moral context. That you cannot build markets and market orders upon a relativistic conception of morality. For one thing, property rights don't work. If you try and base them upon a relatively conception of morality. So when it comes to the question of how one engages this question of limits of markets, where they might be, and if you're going to use the state to put certain barriers down, I mean, one can appeal to the claims of religion, but that's not persuasive to that significant portion of the population that is either nominally religious or not religious at all. To my mind, I think what you basically have to do is make a case based upon reason and evidence, empirical evidence. So what I would call natural law principles, as well as empirical evidence about what happens when you prohibit certain things or certain types of activities. I'm not going to give you an answer on whether it's about drugs or pornography or anything like that. But what I am going to tell you is that, yes, you can develop a principled framework to think through these things in a way that I think is consistent with the demands of reason. And if you want to appeal to people's religious sensibilities, fine, but I think you do that to those communities on their premises, on their territory, on their turf. You don't bring that to a bunch of secularists who have no conception of these things or no interest of these things or think this is all just magical thinking.
I mean, my view is that the pendulum has swung way too far in the direction of opening up vice to market exploitation, whether it's these gambling apps that let you bet on, you know, what the next play is going to be on the football games. I mean, we're just at the beginning of the kind of social dysfunction that's going to create the app-based sports betting things. Pornography, you know, I think we got to overturn these ridiculous Supreme Court decisions that effectively protect privacy as a free speech, I mean, pornography as a free speech right. I think legalization of marijuana is another disaster. I'd like to see banning commercial surrogacy. Section 230 for social media companies, they need to be opened up to liability exposure for the way in which they provide a platform for all kinds of not just pornographic, but all kinds of destructive imaging for young people, whether it's videos that tell them how to commit suicide. I mean, people have no idea how much destructive material there is on the web. And are we surprised that mental health for young people is in the toilet? Are we surprised that they go shoot up schools, given what we, as grown-ups,
have allowed to go into their phones, which are with them at all times. So I think shame on us.
One thing I'll quickly add to that. Once upon a time, religious organizations, churches, synagogues, whatever, would talk about things like our responsibilities to our neighbor. They would warn us against all sorts of vices, some of the things that Rusty is referring to, but they would speak about these things as moral evils, as sins, and there was a heavy weight attached to that. Now, how often does one go to church or synagogue and hear priests or rabbis or ministers talk that way, right? They don't. A lot of them don't, either because they're afraid to do so, or they prefer to talk about economic policy that they know nothing about, right? So what's my point? My point is that many religious leaders have failed to do what is one of the essential prerequisites of their job, which is to morally form people so that when something pops up on your phone and it's clearly an invitation to some sort of whatever, you have the formation to know that that is sick and I'm not going to do that. So before one can even get into a discussion about the role of law and government in regulating these types of things, and I do believe that law and government do have a role in regulating these types of things, we should be asking ourselves, why have religious organizations failed to do this very basic formation that once upon a time you could count upon? Why have they failed to do that? And there's all sorts of reasons why, but I think one of the reasons is that a lot of clergy far more interested in talking about stuff that they think is more interesting to their parishioners or the people in their community rather than doing the difficult but very necessary work of moral formation that's based on the notion that there are moral truths that we can know and we can freely choose them, and that there are things called evil and that we should not be doing them. Religious leaders seem very reluctant to talk about those things unless it's the minimum wage.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sam and Rusty. Our next question comes from Slido, and Cody Arnold asks, how viable is trust busting as a means of reinvigorating authentically free enterprise and breaking the grip of giant corporations over the political culture? And who cares to field that question?
Well, I'll go first. Antitrust law is a disaster. If you look at most antitrust actions, they're not brought forward because of worries about competition. They're usually brought forward by companies wanting to weaponize antitrust law to hurt their competitors. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if you want to know why there are monopolies in place in particular parts of the economy, you can almost certainly, in almost all instances, trace this back to regulatory capture, to cronyism. In other words, ways by which businesses and crony capitalists can effectively capture the regulatory agencies and shift them in particular ways. Antitrust law will not deal with those sorts of issues. You're much better off opening up an economy to as much competition as possible if you want to deal with the problem of these types of monopolies, which in almost all cases are maintained in place because of close connections between businesses, particularly large businesses, and legislators. When, for example, Facebook opened its offices up in Washington, D.C., that was a very clear indication that they were going down the path of, we're going to play the game of capture the regulator rather than freely compete. So antitrust law rarely achieves the purposes for which it was ostensibly designed. It gets captured by some of the very large corporations in the United States that have the money and the lobbying power to do that. Take away a lot of these regulations, the capacity of corporations to weaponize government power to shut down competition goes away.
Yeah, I think we went down a wrong path when Robert Bork's arguments about antitrust law, you know, won the day, that the measure of the harm of giganticism is whether or not it increases prices for the consumer. And older understandings certainly recognize that as a danger. But older understandings of the perils of giganticism were concerned about concentrations of economic power, which are precisely those concentrations can pose political dangers and not just the danger of higher, you know, of higher prices as you impose higher prices. So I think in the Biden administration, the pendulum is swinging back in the direction of this older understanding of antitrust to prevent concentrations of economic power, and that's probably for the best, it seems to me. And we ought to be thinking about Amazon not in terms, not just in terms of the dangers of monopoly and the ability to raise prices, but also on the dangers of having our economy dominated by just a few gigantic corporations, because that it makes, if you have six companies, it makes it easier for them to form a kind of political cartel, even though they're in different industries, and that problem of regulatory capture becomes exacerbated under those circumstances. I do think that we, as conservatives, ought to be thinking about economic policy, about how to encourage small to mid-size to repopulate our economy with a rich ecosystem of large, small, and mid-sized companies.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the floor, and please introduce yourself.
Sure. Hi, my name is Delano Squires, fellow at Heritage Foundation. And my question is, what would be your policy response to future uses of robotics, artificial intelligence, that replace workers on a large scale, particularly in, let's say, blue-collar industries, let's say, construction and transportation? And then related, would you see a wage supplement or a UBI supplement to wages as being equally useful in terms of producing feelings of dignity and self-respect?
You know, I'm not as, I mean, every generation or every two generations, there's been a great anxiety about technological replacement of workers. And those anxieties have not been borne out. I mean, that hasn't been the trajectory. You know, improved productivity of workers tends to create new industries and new opportunities and new avenues of economic activity. So I'm you know, often, I mean, good policymakers, I mean, if I'm correct, it could be that there's a rocky transition to such a future, in which case there has to be some mechanism by which you try to ease the way to this, whatever this new future is. With UBI, I think we face in this decade, we'll go either one of two directions. We're either going to go in the direction of the current economic system as it's configured, which is which has tremendous wealth-creating centers in finance, tech, entertainment, and so on, and that will preserve the what we can of the globalized system, and then we'll deal with populist unrest by UBI. I mean, it's not an accident that it comes from Silicon Valley, which is the biggest winner in the new economy of the neoliberal era. Universal basic income. So you basically have a choice. If the sort of middle America is increasingly dissatisfied with the economic arrangements, you buy their loyalty by saying, we cannot guarantee you a role in this economy as a worker, but we do guarantee you a role as a first world consumer. And I think that I don't want that future. I want a future where we try to think about how we can set the rules of the road of a free economy in such a way that it produces productive roles for median IQ, median educated Americans, so that they feel like they're productive contributing members in a successful society and not simply dependent consumers in somebody else's successful society.
I'll just limit my comments to UBI. I think it's a terrible idea. The reason is it disconnects and devalues work. That's the problem. Economically, countries like Finland have experimented with it, and they got rid of it. They abandoned it because it didn't achieve the ends that they thought it would. But the far more important point is that religions like Judaism and Christianity placed a special emphasis upon work that was completely absent from the pagan mindset and the pagan culture. In the pagan culture, you're a warrior or a statesman or a slave. And that's assuming you're not a man, right? Okay, so that's the first thing. UBI tells us, it sends a message that work is not so important. And remember, the purpose of work is not simply the creation of wealth. That's clearly how it's talked about in biblical terms. But it's also talked about in terms of the virtues or the character formation that occurs in the process of work. Even in the most humblest forms of work, there are opportunities for that type of virtue development. To the extent that UBI, leaving aside the economic problems, which are immense, but to the extent that UBI contributes to the devaluation of the dignity of work, it's not just economically problematic, it's morally and culturally problematic as well. I'm surprised I don't hear more religious leaders pointing this out.
Thank you.
And we'll break convention. This will be our last question, and we'll take that question from the floor. So you're rewarded for your patience standing in line.
Well, no, I got the late invitation to be the third member of the panel, so I think I've still got 20 minutes or something. my question's actually for Samuel. I'm curious, it seemed like the main thrust of your argument was that religious leaders, churches, other organizations like that shouldn't be involved in economics because it's not what their knowledge set is. But I'm curious, since it was mentioned in the first panel, what your thoughts were on a very eminent economist from the last century, Antonio Salazar, who decided to set up his country based on the idea of God, family, and country, and how that played into the economics of the new state.
Well, Salazar set up what was basically a corporatist set of arrangements, right? And not every corporatist is a fascist, but every fascist is a corporatist. I'm not saying Salazar was a corporatist, but what it points to is this faith in the state to organize the economy and society from the top down. That's the essence of corporatism. The other thing about corporatism is that it is extremely economically inefficient because it actively discourages entrepreneurship and competition, which are the driving forces of economic growth and development. It also massively encourages cronyism of the worst type. And it's no coincidence that Portugal, under Salazar, was the poorest European country and still is one of the poorest European countries. Because the corporatist mindset is all about stability and security and actively discourages risk, entrepreneurship, and change. So, to that extent, I'd say that to the extent that Salazar's Portugal or Vichy France or Dollfuss's Austria or fascist Italy or Perón's Argentina embodied corporatist principles, the evidence of the economic backwardness and the political corruption that flows from that is simply undeniable.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking our speakers.